From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Trump administration proposes rolling back parts of the Endangered Species Act.
A particular animal that is frankly more political and draws the ire of industry, those animals would sort of be out of luck.
Fighting back against a cash bail system keeping people who can't pay stuck in jail.
Shocking to some people that this is the state of our justice system in our jails. I think for the families that have been living it day to day, it's nothing new to them.
How 3D printing could cushion us from the trade war with China. Instead of buying some plastic item from China, print it yourself.
Basically anything right now that is made out of plastic. So all of the toys that you see at Walmart and buy off of Amazon, a lot of your household goods, a lot of like custom things that you might use to fix things around your kitchen or your living room.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Wayne County spent hundreds of millions of tax dollars on a new jail, a group points out that if we end the cash bail system, that new jail might not be needed.
If we were to get everyone out of pretrial detention in Wayne County, we'd be down to about 750 people.
The thought is this: improve justice for those awaiting trial and save taxpayer money at the same time. But first, 3D printers are getting renewed attention. As of tomorrow, it will be legal for you to download instructions for making a gun with a home 3D printer. These high-end printers you'd need to make a gun might be out of reach for many people, but critics believe making an untraceable gun at home is not a good thing for the country. But 3D printers could play another role in our lives. They could help cushion us from a trade war, particularly the trade war with China. Instead of buying some plastic tool or toy made in China, you could easily make it at home with a relatively inexpensive 3D printer. Joshua Pierce is a professor of materials science and engineering at Michigan Technological University. He's here with us now. Joshua, how do you see 3D printing being an American consumer's friend in these trade wars?
Well, for the last several years, the cost of 3D printers has really come down. So they're now in the consumer price range, a few hundred dollars to a few thousand. And that gets you a reasonably good printer that's capable not just of prototyping products, but actually manufacturing them. And so it is now definitely physically possible for an everyday consumer to download a free design and print a product for themselves in their own homes.
So give us some examples. What kinds of products might we easily make at home?
Basically anything right now that is made out of plastic. So all of the toys that you see at Walmart and buy off of Amazon, a lot of your household goods, a lot of like custom things that you might use to fix things around your kitchen or your living room, we use it in our labs to make custom scientific equipment all the time, saving ourselves literally tens of thousands of dollars. So it's basically anything that you want that's custom and that can be manufactured at least in part out of plastic. So it doesn't necessarily have to be completely manufactured out of plastic, but you can do most of the parts. So a good example might be something like a quadcopter or a drone, where you can manufacture most of the components with a 3D printer and then buy the few electronic parts off of eBay and build yourself a drone for far less than you would ever purchase one, even without the tariffs.
In your piece that you wrote about this for theconversation.com, you kind of point out we could make our money back pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've done several studies looking at the economics of 3D printing from the consumer's perspective. And pre-trade war, the average consumer printing one object out a week would easily pay for the cost of the printer in under a year. And then if you used the printer that same way, which is very, very conservatively, you would earn rates of return in the hundreds or thousands of percent, depending on what you were printing. Now, the truth be told is that no one only prints one thing a week after you get a 3D printer. You'd find that the more experience you have with it, the more objects you start seeing that you would just purchase kind of every day, you can start making for yourself.
And you talk about things like breast prosthetics or orthotics, cheap toys. It's pretty stunning, the list of things. I think a lot of us don't realize that we could do at home.
Right. So, and the prosthetics and the orthotics, those are the high-end items. So, for example, my orthotics cost $600 for a pair. But after I have a single version of them, I can take some pictures with my cell phone, transfer that into a digital three-dimensional object, and then print out another copy for myself for a couple of dollars. And so instead of buying them for multiple copies of your shoes or changing them, you can make as many copies as you want. And that those kind of savings quickly add up. And after you get that one killer application for yourself, then you can, everything else on top of it is just icing on the cake.
And you also describe an extremely supportive culture of sharing when it comes to printing. Talk to us about that. What's out there for people?
Yeah, so what makes this really possible is that the average person doesn't know CAD, and they would have a hard time, say, designing their own orthotic, and they probably shouldn't. But what they can do is sort of leverage this sharing community on the Internet. And so as the 3D printing has taken off, one of the things that's come with it is this sort of expectation that you share your designs. And so there's literally millions of free designs on the web right now. Basically, everything that you can think of has already, somebody's taken a crack at it, and it might not be exactly what you want, but it might be pretty close. And so when people are first starting with 3D printing, I recommend that they go to one of the sharing sites like My Mini Factory or Umagine, type in the thing that you would like to 3D print or offset your purchase and see if somebody else hasn't already made it. And sort of the sharing community, what it's done is you're obligated to share any improvements you make on the design. And I know that it's helped me personally and helped our lab incredibly by we share all of our designs. And then as people all over the world, people will never meet, make improvements on them, they reshare it back on the web. And so then the next time I want, say, a scientific tool or something for my boat, I can use the design that came from someone else and have a better product that, again, I 3D print in my own home or my own lab.
Wow. And you tell us there are millions of free designs, so jewelry, artwork, musical instruments, household items, tools. That is pretty stunning. What about buying the raw materials that most 3D printers use? I guess, does that material come from China?
A lot of it does today. There are American manufacturers of it. And in the U.S., our access to the filament, it's basically like a long string of plastic spaghetti that you use to 3D print the parts. That's readily available. In other places in the world, it becomes less readily available. And you might imagine that in the future, if, say, the trade war got really bad and we were cut off from all polymers from China, that things might become, it might hurt your ability to 3D print at home. But we do have a relatively newish, exciting potential, and that is to make filament in your own home. And so our team has designed a RecycleBot, which is a waste plastic extruder where you take this tool, take your empty water bottles, throw it in it, and it makes filament that you can then run to your 3D printer. And so there's a bunch of different commercial versions of these, many open source ones, and the one that we make is largely 3D printable. And so you can use your 3D printer to make the RecycleBot that then makes the filament that then you can make whatever you want with.
That solves another problem with all of those plastic water bottles that are going in the recycling bin.
Absolutely. And so this way you know they're recycled, and then it becomes valuable to you too. So you would never think about throwing out a plastic object after you have one of these, because you can turn it back into your next product, whatever that might be.
I'm talking with Joshua Pierce, professor of materials science and engineering at Michigan Technological University, as we look at what can be done at home with 3D printers. On another note, Joshua, I have to ask you about the report that just came out that a Texas group on August 1st is apparently going to post instructions online for how to print a 3D gun. Gun control groups lost an emergency effort to keep those blueprints from being released. So what do we do about a society when anyone could print and make a single-shot weapon on their home 3D printer?
So looking at all the potential good applications of 3D printing that are across-the-board beneficial for everybody, I think the relatively small risk that someone is going to start 3D printing plastic guns is truly small. If you want a gun today in America, it is much easier to buy one. So within my hometown here, there's at least three places you can go purchase a legal firearm. And if you are a criminal and you're not allowed to do that, 3D printing a gun, particularly out of plastic, isn't such a good idea. Now there's many other ways to do it, using machining, using stuff that you can just buy at the hardware store, you can make a better gun. So it does represent a risk. I am a little bit concerned about it because we also have low-cost 3D metal printers that could be used to do that. But the gestalt of it is access to weapons in the United States now is not the issue for criminals. Like, it's not like they can't get them. And being able to access these designs does make it possible for people to possibly start iterating on the designs and making new types of guns. But we haven't seen that yet. And even the company that's doing it, their design repository is mostly looking at old military manuals and measuring the specs off of old guns and putting those up online. And those are already in the public domain. They're just making it easier to get access to them.
circling back to the trade wars, how likely do you believe it is 3D printers one day could pretty much eliminate the need for us to buy, you know, these cheap plastic products from overseas?
I see that is definitely the future. I think economics is going to drive consumer behavior. And so right now, there's very few things you can invest in to get, say, 1,000% return on your money. 3D printers is one of the things that can do that. And so we're seeing this massive explosion in consumer-level desktop 3D printers that is continuing. Now, the thing that makes that slightly uncomfortable is that many of these 3D printers themselves are coming from China. And so if the trade wars continue to escalate, it might change where those printers are coming from and who's manufacturing them. But there's no question that we're headed in that direction. The bigger question is do consumers want that? Are they willing to design things on their own? Are they willing to become makers? And the stats so far say that roughly half of the American adult population would be considered a maker of some kind. Now, they might be making clothing or, you know, refinishing their wood chairs at home or something like that. And so the next step to go to digital manufacturing with 3D printing really isn't that far from, you know, someone that is used to kind of making things for themselves. So we'll see. I'm optimistic that we're going to see this move in that direction, and that will provide American consumers some protection from any type of trade war, no matter what ends up happening in the future.
Joshua Pierce, professor of materials science and engineering at Michigan Technological University. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, the most endangered species in our state, you ask? The Poweshiek skipperling butterfly.
We once knew it from 300 sites across the Midwest, and now it's only in 4 sites in Michigan, possibly one still hanging on in Wisconsin, and then one location up in Manitoba.
We'll discuss what hope is left for this dwindling species. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Trump administration has rolled out a proposal that would strip out key provisions of the Endangered Species Act. This law was passed 45 years ago, designed to keep endangered plant and animal species from going extinct. Brett Hartle is the Government Affairs Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit whose mission is to protect endangered species through activism, legal action, and petitions. Brett, what's in this proposal? How would it change the Endangered Species Act as we know it now?
So basically, what these proposals do, and there's a set of regulations that the Trump administration has proposed, is they weaken protections for critical habitat, the places that animals and plants, you know, need and are essential for their survival and ultimately for their recovery. It weakens protections under the law that are designed to make sure that the federal government in particular doesn't cause endangered species to decline, because the federal government is so large and its impacts are so great that, you know, their impacts can be felt very broadly. And then it also weakens protections for species listed as threatened. So there's two different categories, endangered and threatened, under the Act. And for threatened species, which are the lower level, it would remove protections for those animals and plants and basically say, if you get listed as threatened moving forward, starting today, it will still be legal to kill a threatened species. So that's a huge reduction in protections. This applies nationwide. It will harm the recovery. It will slow down the recovery of hundreds of species all around the country, because if you take away those protections, you just make it that much harder.
So what this proposal would do, among other things, would the protections for these threatened plants and animals, it would be on a case-by-case basis if the proposal is approved?
That's right.
And that would mean what?
Well, it would mean that for a particular animal that is frankly more political and draws the ire of industry, those animals would sort of be out of luck, because each species would get sort of a review as to whether or not we should protect it by saying things like it's illegal to kill them or it's illegal to injure them. And you can imagine that in this administration, which is very political, that, you know, maybe for some species they'll still get that protection, but for things that the industry doesn't like, they'll get nothing. And that will just make it much, much harder to protect them. I mean, many endangered species have waited a very long time to get protection. It takes a long time. And every year you make it harder, makes it slower, it becomes more costly to recover them. So it's just cumulatively a really terrible set of ideas that will harm wildlife across the board, and including in Michigan.
Let's talk about that. Give us some, here in Michigan, how many endangered species do we have in Michigan? I'm wondering, you know, some examples of what might be impacted in our state.
Michigan has 27 threatened and endangered species. There's 19 different animals, 8 plants. Some of them are endemic just to Michigan, like the Michigan monkey flower, which is only found in northern Michigan. Some of them are more widespread, such as, you know, the Indiana bats or the Canada lynx or the Great Lakes piping plover, which is, you know, this tiny shorebird with a very small population that nests around all of the Great Lakes. And for these species, just like any others around the country, the Trump administration is proposing to weaken their protections for critical habitat, you know, the last places they're found, and basically green light and rubber stamp a lot of basically irresponsible development, all sort of in the name of, you know, short-term gain and at the expense of endangered species.
Now, officials from the Interior Department are saying, well, you know, this is part of President Trump's order to reduce government regulation, and that some of those regulations in the Endangered Species Act go back decades and we don't need them anymore.
Right. And of course, you know, that is their only main talking point. You know, the reality is that for 45 years, the Endangered Species Act has worked remarkably well. It's kept 99% of all of the animals and plants on its list from going extinct, and a majority are on the road to recovery. And we've recovered species and we've saved them without, you know, crashing the American economy. It's a false choice. It's a false dichotomy that we can't have business and endangered species. We've been doing both very well for a very long time. And this isn't some reasonable accommodation. This is really just a giveaway to really large special interests. And it's just not true that the regulations are outdated. I mean, in fact, some of them were revised just 2 years ago by the Obama administration. Some of the things that they rolled back, they literally changed back in 2015. So, you know, they're sticking to these talking points, but they're really not accurate.
Congress does not have a role in this. So it really, there is a public comment period between now and September 24th. So what's at stake in your view as people weigh in on the pros and cons of this?
The stakes are basically every endangered species and whether we actually save it. For folks that in Michigan that love endangered species in Michigan and want to see healthy ecosystems, you know, thriving wild places with abundant wildlife and plants, you know, a lot of that is now going to be at risk. It's not going to fall away immediately, but over the long term, the damage will be significant. So the public comment period is literally the one chance that everyone has to weigh in and tell the administration what it thinks. And, you know, after that, groups like ours and others will go to court and say that this is, you know, outrageous and illegal. But it certainly will help if millions of Americans also say that this is a terrible idea.
Comments, as we said, are being accepted through September 24th. We've put a link to that government website for your comments at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Brett Hartle with the Center for Biological Diversity, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
One of those 27 endangered species here in Michigan is a tiny butterfly. It's called the Powasheik skipperling, And one of the very few places where it is still found is in Oakland County. Here with us now is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Tamara Smith. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So tell us about this little butterfly that seems to be heading the endangered species list in Michigan. What is a Powashiek skipperling butterfly?
So Powashiek skipperlings are small little butterflies. They're only about an inch big, and they're found in remnants of native prairies, historically in Iowa, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, as well as Manitoba. And they've been largely extirpated from most of those areas.
That's an interesting word. What is extirpated?
So people are out looking for them, and they're not finding them anymore. So basically extinct from those areas.
All right. And we know some of the last ones are found in a part of Oakland County. Where are they to be found in Oakland County?
Yeah, so they're in native remnant prairie fens in Oakland County. And they're only found in four locations that we know of in Oakland County in Michigan. And that's one of the last remaining populations of the species in the whole world.
What kind of job does the Powashiek skipperling have in nature? I guess I'm wondering, what might we be losing?
Yeah, I think for this species, I mean, it's a pollinator, so it does do pollination services. It's only found in small little native prairies, so it doesn't go out and pollinate, you know, food crops or anything like that. But I think with this species, you know, it's kind of a canary in the coal mine, and their loss may indicate that something else is going wrong within the ecosystem in which they live. And healthy ecosystems are something in which we all depend on. And Powashiek are just one example of a prairie butterfly that has kind of witnessed this big, dramatic, and sharp decline. And we're noticing similar patterns in other pollinators, such as bumblebees and other prairie butterflies. And so when we're thinking about conservation of this species, we're thinking about conservation of pollinators in a larger context. And we're trying to help a whole suite of species.
When you talk about this decline, how quickly? So if we're talking about the Powashiek skipperlings who are in Oakland County, can you give us a comparison as far as the number, like from what to what in what amount of time?
And maybe it's easier to think about it first off kind of in the larger context of their historical range.
Mm-hmm.
So to give people a picture of what kind of went on with the species, it was a very commonly found butterfly across the Midwest. Minnesota was historically the heart of the range of the species. And in the early 2000s, people started to notice, you know, that it wasn't being found anymore when folks were out looking. And now we estimate that it's been lost from about 98% of its historical range. So we once knew it from 300 sites across the Midwest, and now it's only in four sites in Michigan, possibly one still hanging on in Wisconsin, and then one location up in Manitoba. And then in Michigan specifically, there was a handful of sites where we found the species historically, about eight or so that were kind of strongholds that had the species, you know, not very long ago, maybe 2008, where we were still seeing them. The sites kind of were steady in terms of numbers over time. The highest daily count that we know of in Michigan was nearly 400, you know, that you saw on one day. And that was only back in 2011. And then since then, there's been kind of a decline in Michigan, and about four of those sites, we think the species is no longer there, while four of them are still hanging on. And the numbers have been pretty low, but kind of steady over the last 4 or 5 years, where you're seeing for a daily high count anywhere from 20 to 75 animals.
Oh, and that's a big difference from hundreds.
Yes, definitely a big difference from hundreds, and especially a big difference from in Minnesota, where it was kind of, you'd see two on a flower and, you know, everywhere you go pretty much in those prairies, and now you don't see them at all.
Well, here's the question, Tam. What might be done to keep the species going? I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, the butterfly house at the Detroit Zoo, or certainly the Minnesota Zoo has a strong butterfly conservation program.
Yeah, and so we have many conservation partners that are working together to really prevent the extinction of the Powashiek skipperling at this point. We're focusing on the few remaining sites in Michigan and Manitoba where the power sheiks are still present. A couple different zoos are developing captive rearing strategies to help bolster the existing populations, and we're also doing habitat management, and we're at the same time trying to investigate the causes of the decline and try to figure out what's going on.
What's your guess? What is your sense as a biologist? What's your sense of what's going on and why this powashiek skipperling is so close to being extinct?
Yeah, I think, you know, the loss of habitat and the degradation of habitat has led to the initial decline of the powashiek skipperlings. There's not that much native remnant prairie habitat that still exists. A lot of that was lost historically, mm-hmm. but the causes of that sharp decline that was very recent still remains a mystery in our eyes.
So what kind of theories are you thinking of scientifically as far as what might be going on, apart from the fact that we've built shopping centers and subdivisions over what used to be the prairie lands where these butterflies lived, but what else could be going on?
Yeah, I think the initial decline was because of the habitat degradation and fragmentation. But what has been ongoing over the longer time frame is different than that swift decline that we saw in the early 2000s. And we suspect that it was something pervasive and wide-ranging that caused the decline. It might be things like changing weather patterns that have a negative effect. It could be a widespread disease or the use of pesticides. We really don't know right now. It's kind of a mystery on what exactly happened that caused that swift decline. But we're trying to figure that out.
So that's the mission. And to those who will say, well, we've seen millions of species become extinct throughout time, why should we worry about this one little butterfly?
Powashiek are just one example of a prairie butterfly that's witnessing this type of decline. We're seeing this type of decline in bumblebees and other types of pollinators. And so we got to figure out what's going on here. There's some kind of larger problem. Another important thing to point out is that, you know, what we're doing to save the powashiek also benefits multiple other species. So, for example, we're doing habitat restoration work at those Michigan sites, and that is helping to save other native species that live there. In addition, we're building expertise in butterfly captive rearing at the zoos, and that has already directly resulted in conservation of other imperiled species, such as the federally threatened Dakota skipper, which was successfully reintroduced into historical habitat for the first time last year by the Minnesota Zoo and our partners that all work together to make that happen. And another key part is that the partnerships that we have built are really a key to this program's success. And we're constantly learning from each other and doing collaborative and collective research and applying that work to powashiek, but also to a suite of other species.
And I know that the Shiawassee Basin Preserve in Oakland County is kind of where the powashiek skipperling, where it calls home. But would it be fair to say you'd probably prefer to not have people trying to tromp around to find this little butterfly so nature lovers don't endanger them further by seeking them out?
Yes, we really do appreciate everyone's enthusiasm and support and, you know, their interest in the powashiek skipperling. But it's in such a bad state right now that any footstep that you take in their habitat, and their habitat's very sensitive, you have the potential with every step to be crushing an egg or a larvae, you know, one of the caterpillars. If you're trying to take a photograph and chasing around the adult butterflies, that could interrupt their natural mating processes and their egg-laying processes. And we really can't afford the loss of any of them at this point. They're at such low numbers. We really are trying to encourage folks to kind of love them, but from a distance.
Tam Smith is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Like so many other states, Michigan is at a kind of crossroads when it comes to marijuana. The drug is still illegal at the federal level, of course, but public opinion is shifting, and more than 60% of Americans now favor legalizing weed. And, of course, this November, Michiganders will vote on whether or not to allow recreational marijuana use. What does this all mean for Michigan's economy, healthcare, criminal justice system? Let us know your questions about the future of marijuana in Michigan. It's easy. Go to MichiganRadio.org and look for the stateside question box on the right side of the page. Still to come, there are people in Michigan sitting in jail right this very moment because they just cannot afford bail.
Over 60% of people in Wayne County's jails are there pre-trial, meaning they have not been convicted of a thing.
That story is up next, and then we learn what brought the National Association of Black Journalists to Detroit for this year's big convention.
Everybody in the world is coming to Detroit, the comeback city, the place where, oh, wait a minute, we never thought that this would happen. And it's happening. So they want to see it. They want to be a part of it. And it just seemed to make sense.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We all accept that in this country, when you're charged with a crime, you are innocent until proven guilty. But there are people sitting in jail, unconvicted, yet unable to go home because they can't afford to pay their bail. So they're left with two choices. You plead guilty to the crime or you sit there until your case finally makes it to trial. And with many courts so backlogged, that could take months. Bridge Magazine reports about 41% of people sitting in Michigan jails are there because they can't afford bail. And in Detroit, that figure rises to something like 60%. Enter the new Detroit Justice Center. It's joining with the National Bail Project with a mission of helping get these people out on bail. Amanda Alexander is with us. She's the CEO and director of the Detroit Justice Center. Amanda, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And we want to welcome Rasha Amuleke, who is a bail disruptor. And we're going to talk about just what that means. Rasha, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amanda, what is the mission of the Detroit Justice Center?
So our work is to support families who face criminal justice involvement in some way. So starting a bail fund was really an obvious choice for us. As you pointed out, over 60% of people in Wayne County's jails are there pre-trial, meaning they have not been convicted of a thing. And that has several implications. So for the justice system, it totally perverts the presumption of innocence. People can fight their cases much better when they are home. If they are, you know, waiting in jail, awaiting trial, they're more likely to plead guilty just so that they can go home. You know, people could be there, and if they are told, well, if you just pleaded this misdemeanor, if you pleaded this crime, you can go home and tuck your kids in tonight. They're more likely to do that. What we have found is that those are the implications for the justice system, but there are implications for families. So even a night in jail can cause someone to lose their job if they don't show up for their shift. If they are in a bit longer and they miss a rent payment, they've lost their housing. They could lose their children. If they miss picking their child up from school, CPS gets called, a foster care case is opened. So there are just all of these rippling consequences.
And when we say this 60% in Wayne County, we're talking low income, because we wouldn't be if people had the money to be able to post the bail. And enter your work, Rasha, as a bail disruptor.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
What I do is help bond people out who typically can't afford it. People that we've identified as eligible for our program have already been identified as indigent, meaning that they can't afford to post their bonds. The median bail income in Detroit we've identified as under $5,000. And so there are people sitting in there for $500, and they would have those devastating consequences that Amanda went into. We not only bond them out, but we provide wraparound services to make sure that they get to court. And usually it's as simple as a court reminder, or if they have issues with transportation, we would work with community partners, such as the Black Youth Project 100 has been a vital piece to be able to provide transportation to our clients, and to refer them to other services that they might need, whether it's childcare or connect them with employment and other services like that.
So you want to, as you say, build this kind of wraparound
safety
net, because I'm sure that one missed communication and a missed court date, and suddenly the situation is very, very dark again for these folks?
Exactly. So a failure to appear in court can turn into a warrant, which is hanging over someone's head. You know, they could be pulled over and right back in the same situation. So we want to provide whatever wraparound supports that we can to make sure that that doesn't happen.
So where does the money come from when you say you go in and you're posting bail for people who don't have it? How does this work? Where does the money come from? And how do you sustain it?
The money has been fundraised over time. We have a national bail fund of over $30 million that revolves. And what that means is that when we post the bail and we follow the history of the person's case, it is then returned to us minus court fees. And then for every dollar that we have, we are able to revolve that back into helping 2 to 3 people every year.
So when you say it's returned to us, just for people who are listening who aren't familiar with how the criminal justice system works.
So we bond people out free of charge. And once they're case has finished, we get that money returned to be able to then circulate it back to help other people.
You know, bail fund is one way of dealing with cash bail and low-income defendants. But what, Amanda, I'll start with you, a true lasting reform look like in your view?
Yeah, I think that this is all part of a stopgap effort to...
image of plugging your finger in
exactly,
the holes in the dike.
Exactly. I mean, this is an act of solidarity with, you know, low-income people in our community who are disproportionately impacted by this problem. But it's a temporary measure, we hope, on the way to ending cash bail entirely, ending pretrial detention. I think it's part of a larger issue of rethinking the wisdom of jails, you know, in this country. If we were to get everyone out of pretrial detention in Wayne County, we'd be down to about 750 people. Right now, Wayne County is moving to build a new jail that would house 2,200 adults and a youth detention center of 160 beds. And so I think that people are pausing and rethinking, do we need jails or could we be reinvesting in other things? And that's a much heavier lift, you know, I think, remaking the justice system. But this is one piece of that work.
And when you think of the climate in America in 2018, does it seem like a heavier lift?
In some ways, yes, but in others, no. I mean, I think for a long time, families have been going through this quietly. So even though it's shocking to some people that this is the state of our justice system in our jails, I think for the families that have been living it day to day, it's nothing new to them, and they are getting more and more organized and, you know, exercising. I think there's a strong voice around change in the criminal justice system these days, and that's not going away. That's only picking up.
Rasha, take us into the world of someone who is stuck there in a jail cell, pretrial, not convicted, and doesn't have the money. What is life like for them and for their families?
Well, I can provide an example of a story that kind of really stayed with me. One of our clients, who has 3 children, was incarcerated for about a week. He not only lost his own job, but his domestic partner also had to quit her own job to take care of the kids. So they went from a 2-income household to none. And that's just a small example of just how devastating those impacts can be.
I think it really drives home, too, the impacts on not just that individual, but their entire family. Mm-hmm. So as you see, this is a family that went from 2 incomes to no incomes over a few days in jail. And we see that day in, day out. In another case of someone that rebailed out, it was a young man in his early 20s, and every day that he was in for about a week because of $500 that his family couldn't afford. He was missing his job. He was missing school. His family couldn't afford the bail. They also could not afford to put money on a phone card to communicate with him. So he was trading his breakfast and lunch every day to be able to use someone else's phone card to call home. So that is the level of poverty of families caught up in the system. And, you know, again, these are not outlier cases. These are cases that happen hundreds of times every week.
And again, just to be very clear, we are talking about people who have been accused of a crime, not convicted. So legally, they are innocent.
Exactly.
What's at stake here? I can tell just by hearing you and seeing you that this work matters so much to both of you.
What's at stake is the destruction of a community because of their economic status. The fact that this has been a two-tiered system of justice. These are allegations at this point, and people deserve a day in trial to see their case through and to prove their standpoint.
It's very easy to say, fine, I just want to get out of here. I'll plead guilty to this misdemeanor. I just want to go home. And then you have a conviction.
And then you have a conviction on your record, and that follows you. Whether it's looking through employment, trying to get a loan, these are devastating impacts with real people being involved that most people, if they're not living it, don't even consider.
And Amanda, I know this is the Detroit Justice Center, but this is the fact that you're part of the National Bail Project. This is a countrywide issue. We're feeling this in every corner of the country.
Yeah, there's a growing national movement around ending cash bail. I think that that is something that, you know, people across Michigan, you know, can certainly take up. There's a broader look at, you know, jails themselves and the need for them versus other types of community investment. It's part of a much broader conversation. I think cash bail's days are numbered. I think that there is this growing consensus that this is no way to run a justice system. But we're also very concerned about what would replace cash bail.
Yes, because I'm wondering, is it being done in other parts of the world where you could point to somebody and say, look how that's working?
Well, I think it's only the U.S. and the Philippines that do cash bail like this. So the other parts of the world are far ahead. But I think in certain jurisdictions in the U.S., so Washington, D.C. is one place that people look to. Basically, the data has proven out that you do not need money bail to get people back to court. All you need is a simple court reminder, so a text message. And instead, what we're seeing is sometimes when we bail out clients, they then have to get an ankle monitor, so a tether. They have to pay $200 to get that installed and then $100 every month to maintain it. And again, these are people with a presumption of innocence. So we had a young boy who was bailed out about 17 years old and had to report right away to get his ankle monitor put on. He's going to have to wear this around his ankle all summer. He's not going to want to wear shorts in this 95-degree weather. He can't submerge the tether, so he can't go swimming with his friends. These are the types of things that, you know, people are facing when they are presumed to be innocent. And so more surveillance is not the answer. We do not need to replace the money bail system with a system of, you know, in-home surveillance.
So what do we replace it with?
Like I said, court reminders. So just, you know, sending people a simple text message has been proven to get people back to court, and also supportive services. So we know that people were already on the brink, you know, if this is the arrest that pushed their family over. And so our hope is that with the holistic support of the Detroit Justice Center and the Bail Project and our community partners, we can really kind of get them back on track.
Amanda Alexander and Rasha Amuleki are with the Detroit Justice Center, working with the National Bail Project to help get people out on bail who cannot afford it otherwise. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Journalists descend upon Detroit for the annual NABJ convention, the National Association of Black Journalists. The NABJ has not held its convention in Detroit since 1992. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley is honorary convention co-chair. Rochelle, you just stop and think for a moment. 1992, Coleman Young was still Detroit's mayor. So much has happened in 26 years.
This is almost like Back to the Future. People are going to be stunned by where we are now. We don't have flying cars yet, but they're working on it out of what used to be the worst site of ruined porn in America, but is now going to be the Michigan Central Station for self-driving cars. So it's a whole different place now.
And why did the NABJ choose Detroit for this year's convention?
It was Detroit's turn. Everybody in the world, and when I say the world, I mean around the globe, is coming to Detroit, the comeback city, the place where, oh, wait a minute, we never thought that this would happen. And it's happening. So they want to see it. They want to be a part of it. And it just seemed to make sense.
And how do local NABJ members like you, how do you plan to put a Detroit feel to the 5 days of this convention?
Well, we're going to keep it real. For instance, one of the things that we did was a local magazine that sort of highlighted some of the things that you can only find in Detroit. I mean, we all know about FAGO and we know about, you know, the things that are made here, but there are people here who you can't find anyplace else, you know, Henry the Hatter and Burt's and the DIA. You know, everybody has a museum, but nobody has our museum. I think that the main thing is just to give them all things Detroit. On top of that, you don't have to be a journalist to enjoy NABJ. We have a lot of public events that will talk about things that are happening here, this National Town Hall on Diversity, where they're going to talk about Detroit's renaissance and whether it's real for everyone. That's tonight on the eve of the convention. right over at Hockey Town Cafe in that city theater.
And that's open to anybody, right?
That's open to the public.
Okay.
And we've got a big reception and fundraiser tonight at Little Caesars Arena. Little Caesars Arena wasn't even a thought in somebody's head 20, you know, years ago. Well, maybe, you know, Mr. I. But that is something that didn't exist that they'll see. Dan Gilbert and Quicken Loans has embraced this convention like no other CEO and company in our history. They're doing so many different activities. They're doing that Day of Entrepreneurial Service where instead of going out and building a Habitat for Humanity house, we're going to help small businesses learn how to build good relationships with the media.
You know, I want to take a moment and kind of dig into that. So you're going to have top journalists, top PR people, and sitting there in front of, you know, small business owners and nonprofit groups and helping them how? What kind of advice will they be offering?
Well, there's three components of it. The first thing we're going to do is help with their social media and branding. No small business and no nonprofit that wants to make some money should be existing without being on the web. If you don't have a website where somebody can Google you, which is literally like how people determine whether you're legitimate these days, you have to do that. Those are things that can be set up like in 15 minutes. We're going to talk about handling crises. If you make a mistake and you're trying to figure out how to handle that with the media, they're going to do that, including some mock scenarios and mock interviews. And the other thing is just how to build a good relationship with the media. You don't send out a press release to someone you don't know the day before an event and get mad because nobody shows up. So lots of real practical tips.
Rochelle, what can this convention do to kind of attack the issue of diversity in newsrooms?
Well, the one big thing that NABJ has always prided itself on was making sure that companies, and we have the biggest career fair of any media organization in the country, those folks come out and they get to meet the journalists that we give an opportunity to meet them, and they get to see how much talent there is and who these people are. And sometimes it's just a matter of meeting someone. I can tell you that 50% of NABJ members for years got their jobs through that NABJ job fair, where you go through, you meet people, you give them your resume. It's an amazing opportunity to see someone you might not otherwise see, or to meet someone that you didn't realize you were looking for, and bring people into your newsroom who look like a lot of the people in your city.
Journalists are coming to this NABJ convention in a year when the current occupant of the Oval Office has branded you all as enemy of the people. How are you hoping this convention helps people respond to these ongoing attacks?
Well, as much as we can blame Donald Trump for a lot of that, and he deserves blame for a lot of that, some of it is our fault. We have got to get back to our basics. That means people who are columnists like me and opinion writers like me or opinion commentators, they're one category. People who are supposed to be bringing you the news that's balanced, that tells you both sides of a story, that's reporters. We've had a lot of reporters letting, because of their frustration and anger at what's going on in America, let opinion seep into what they're doing. We can't do that. We have to keep it honest. We have to keep it real so that people trust us and know that what we're trying to explain to them is something that's as close to the truth as we can bring them. So this is another opportunity for us to teach that, to do that, and to show people that we know that we need to work on it.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley, honorary co-chair of the annual convention of the National Association of Black Journalists that is running through Sunday in Detroit. Rochelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And time for our regular friendly reminder. We always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? Let us know. What issues do you want to hear more about or people that you want to hear more about? You can find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Joey Heron. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.